Welcome back, friends. On this episode of the Everyday Hero Show, I talked to Mr. Goddard, Peter Goddard. He's a high school teacher of mine. And I had him on the show because he taught one of my favorite classes in high school. And that class specifically talked about power, race, religion, sex, all of these things that I feel in the past five, maybe 3 to 5 years have really blown up into the it's everywhere, all over Twitter, all over social media. And specifically, I wanted to have him on because with the with this new laser eye focus on CRT, I really wanted to understand if the class that I took 10 years ago was CRT. Was I getting the CRT that everyone is freaking out about? Because prior to knowing anything about CRT and after, I still to this day think that that's leadership. The class I'm speaking about, the one that he taught, was one of the best classes I have ever taken. I think I've used that class the most in all of my life. We had a fantastic conversation. We go on for a little bit because we get into the nitty gritty. We talk about what CRT is. We talk about why it's been so obsessed about in the culture, in the news. We talk about cancel culture. Is it accountability? Is it censorship? Is it a punishment? And then we end the conversation talking about the framing of the right versus the left. It's a very interesting conversation. I love talking to Mr. Goddard again. It's always a goddamn pleasure. I hope you guys enjoy. And if you guys are just as confused as I am as why the culture seems, why today it seems like we're doing worse in race today than we did 10 years ago. If you think that the culture right now is more toxic than it was before, and that's not the progress you thought that would happen, and you're super confused, you would learn a lot from this conversation that I have with Mr. Goddard. At least he taught me a lot. So enjoy. Just bare bones, you're still at North, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Year
number 24.
24?
Yes, sir.
My goodness. Yeah. I was thinking about that too, because it's 2022. It's 10 years since I graduated.
I was about to ask you. You're around 10 years, isn't it? Oh my God.
It's crazy. I mean, once you become an adult, it just starts to move. You know,
it sure does. Like, I'm telling you, if it wasn't for like albums dropping or sports teams winning, I don't know how I would remember years.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Like, I define time now through like music I heard and my sports teams that won.
I have to give so much credit to you for you keeping up with the young hip kids. I gave up. Mr. Goddard, I've given up. I can't keep up with the little darts and the little yachties and the little, it's over.
I've tried. I know this was kind of our last time we did this, but I have tried so hard with some of these young cats, and I just can't do it. Like, I know who they are.
Yes.
I'll listen to anything kids tell me to, and then I'll say, I'm glad you like it.
You're better than me, Mr. Goddard. You're much better than me. So I really do want to get into this because I do want to spend a whole lot of time in the meats of this. Welcome back, everybody, to the Everyday Hero Show, where I bring to you someone in my life or someone in your life that brings us joy, happiness, and good things all around, but does not get the credit that they deserve. We have a returning guest, a very important guest, Mr. Goddard, Peter Goddard, teacher at Newton North High School. Welcome back.
Thank you so much. Always good to see you, Q. Always good.
I appreciate that. I just want to start this off with reminding folks, there's going to be in the link in the description box below where we talked about leadership specifically. And this is the main reason I wanted for you to come back, Mr. Goddard, because to this day, and I say this every time I speak about high school or just education pre-college, obviously, because college is just a totally different game.
Yeah.
Leadership was and still is my favorite class of all time.
Oh, wow.
But with that being said, with this new culture, this new perspective on life, I'm just looking back and I'm still so happy we had that class.
Yeah.
I really think it's one of the best things ever. Like, it really allowed me to view, you know, people always say you learn stuff in high school that you'll never use for the rest of your life. It's the one class I've used probably the absolute most
since
high school.
That's wonderful to hear. Yeah, yeah.
So just real quick, brief summary of leadership. We don't have to go into details like last time. Well, how would you describe what leadership is?
So leadership in a diverse society is a committee chosen class that so students are nominated and then they go in front of, and then we bring the names up at a committee and try to make a class that best represents the cross section of the entire school. But it's really heavy on seniors, and we always aim for like low double digit juniors. And there's about 50 kids. And what it is that it's a class that examines leadership modes, you know, different ways of being leadership, of being leaders, developing skills. So it's, you know, we do believe that leadership is to some extent is something that can be taught. It's not just something you have or don't have. And it also seeks to look at the social world in which we're about to go into, in which we've come from, and to be able to understand that. So you have to be able to, so we have units that deal with the concept of race and then different racial identities, ethnic identities, gender identities, sexual orientation, economic class, how all these things affect education, how all these things kind of reveal how the United States has kind of been created and built and sustained. And we do make sure that it's clear that it's about the US only, because for example, concepts of race are very different in different countries. Like our conception of race in the US is wildly different than the conception of race in Brazil. Although the dark skin, light skin thing is still there. So, you know, you've kind of got all that kind of stuff there. So that's quick. As quick as I can put it.
The dark tail license thing is usually there. I mean, no matter where you go, it's
Cuba, usually. Puerto Rico, yeah, all that.
It's always
India.
I love that explanation, and that's I would describe it very, very similarly. But to a lot of people in 2020, what you just said is critical race theory. So I do, exactly, that's why I want to talk about this. But I want to just do a brief description of what I got. It's based from an article from the New York Times, a brief history from the New York Times by J.C. Fortin. And they describe it like this, just a little bit of reading here, Mr. Goddard. The person widely credited for coining the term is Kimberly Williams Crenshaw, a law professor at UCLA School of Law and Columbia Law School. Critical race theorists reject the philosophy of colorblindness. They acknowledge the stark racial disparities that have persisted in the United States despite decades of civil rights reforms, and they raise structural questions about how racist hierarchies are enforced, even among people with good intentions. And then it goes on to say, critical race theory is not a single worldview. The people who study it may disagree on some of their main points. As Professor Crenshaw put it, CRT is more a verb than a noun. And then last little paragraph here, it is a way of seeing, attending to, accounting for, tracing, and analyzing the ways that race is produced, she said, the ways that racial inequality is facilitated, and the ways that our history has created these inequalities that now can be almost effortlessly reproduced unless we attend to the existence of these inequalities. So I said a whole lot of stuff there. And I just wanted to pick out one sentence and really get your thoughts on this.
Okay.
Tracing and analyzing how race is produced. What do you think she means by that? Because everything else, I agree, and maybe that is a situation. I don't know the details, but tracing and analyzing how race is produced. What do you think she means there?
So I'll try to do this without the context of the rest of what she said, but I will say, when using the term race is produced, what I hear in that is the idea that we're going along with this notion that race has been created, that race is a social construct, that race is something that we've created for a reason, you know, in terms of that, and that it's a power dynamic. So, you know, as we may or may, maybe we don't know, depending on who's viewing this, you know, race is not a biological thing. It just isn't. I mean, that, and if anyone wants to argue it, you know, I'm sorry. It's just not true. Just like the world is round, Mr. Kyrie Irving. But anyway, so when I hear that, what I think she's really talking about is like what are the ways in that race has been used and created to, in order to keep certain people on top. One thing that's very interesting to look historically is that the notion of race changes quite often, depending on who we want to keep in power. And that is what I hear in the word produced, you know. In terms of that.
See, that's the thing, because it's just a little confusing for me, because so race isn't biological. And right. Then we talk about how race is produced and how race is used, and it changes all the time. Yeah. And because it's changing all the time, I think to go back and to try to link it all together to apply it to why what's happening today is happening today to the people of different races, the way we look at it today is very, very, very difficult. Mm. It just seems like a very, very difficult thing to do. I've always read and heard that MLK Jr. speech, as the goal of it is to reach the whole colorblindness goal. Like, that's what I heard and read that speech as. Like, the goal is so we can one day become colorblindness. So we can all one day become colorblind. Do you agree with that? Do you think that's a good thing? Do you think that's a goal that we should have?
I don't think it's a good thing. And I also don't think it's what MLK said. I think what MLK was saying is that we get to a point where race doesn't have the power dynamics that it has. And in that regard, race doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. Colorblindness is an erasing of people, in my opinion. You know, for example, if, you know this, but maybe other people, you know, my wife is Black and Puerto Rican. If people said, I don't see color when I see you, she would be very offended by that. Because, like, you know, part of who she is her experience. And part of what her experience has been from those things of being Black and Puerto Rican, right? So, and it always seems like, you know, and I could be overstepping my bounds here, but I've rarely, if ever, heard colorblindness as a goal from any person of color. I've only heard it out of the mouths of white folks. You know, shouldn't we aspire to this, right?
Yeah.
And the thing about it is that, to go to MLK, is that, you know, he's basically been assassinated twice. He was, you know, murdered by the bullet, and then we whitewashed his history. Mm-hmm. So that basically all he's worth is the I Have a Dream speech, which is an aspirational thing. But we forget, especially the last 5 years of his life, particularly the last 3 years of his life, a lot of the stuff he said would be considered quite radical. He believed in universal basic income.
Talk to me.
Yeah. he believed in the anti-militarism and anti-imperialism, you know, the military was a horrible, horrible thing. He was starting to connect a lot of the dots, and it was about coming to get that check that was owed Black America. So, you know, everyone thinks of him as just the pastor that made you feel good and wanted you to hold hands. And, you know, that color of their skin and content of their character line has been just misrepresented over and over again, willfully, I would say to you, by the right as something. And so I don't think colorblindness is ever a goal. I think the goal is to make sure that, you know, is to really deconstruct maybe the concept of race, because within the concept of race is the concept of power, and we're trying to get rid of the power.
And that's, you see, that's a tricky thing for me, right? That's a tricky thing for me, because maybe I said it wrong when I said I heard it and that's what I always thought it was, because I get it.
You've been taught that. I'm sure you've been taught
that. Because I get both sides, right? You want color not to be an issue when it comes to opportunities and all of these things, right? But you also want people to understand, this is my color and I love it. So it's so hard, right? You want to spread the word, but you also don't want that to be a barrier or something that people think about when it comes to just the regular stuff, getting a job, going to school, living your life.
It's almost like the idea of, you know, how we look at the idea of difference. you know, in many times in our culture, we think of difference as a hierarchy. One's better or worse. We don't really talk about it as difference, you know? And I think that's really the tricky thing that we're trying to do with dismantling the notion of race, is to say that there's a difference. Yes, there's a difference between you and me, but that difference shouldn't matter.
Exactly.
And so, but we're not going to get rid of the difference part. We have to get rid of the matter part.
yes.
So when you hear Black Lives Matter, right, which somehow has been turned into this, you know, controversial statement. I mean, I don't know if you ever seen Michael Che's stand-up around the idea of talking about Black Lives Matter. Is like, you know, we're just saying it matters.
Oh yeah. Oh,
yeah, you know, just saying yes. It matters. Like that's, you know, that's the other thing that kind of happens. And that goes back to framing. You know, I'm sure we'll get into
that. Oh yes, I love that article that you sent me. That Medium post. It was actually fantastic, and we will get there in a hot second. Yeah. But just to finish up here on this, the whole CRT thing. I really don't know what people are upset about. If CRT isn't like is this huge problem, and if it's just identifying the issues that are currently part of the system, the institutions, and just pointing them out, I don't see how that can be a problem. Look, I'm just saying it from my perspective. Like I said from the beginning, I really think, like, honest to God, if people think that the leadership class that I was part of is a part of this big CRT BS, I think they should. Maybe they should start doing it in every high school. I know that sounds
insane. No, it doesn't. And this is what's crazy is that, first of all, at least you read up on CRT.
Yeah.
This again goes to framing. The CRT has now been to include any kind of conversation about race.
That's it.
And like Senator Ted Cruz got up at Judge Brown Jackson's, hearings this week and holds up a picture of how to be an anti-racist baby.
The babies.
It's like the sign of the devil coming through. I'm like, no, that's just a book that's talking about race. That's not CRT.
Yes.
I will say, to kind of give you, because, you know, everyone says CRT is not being done in schools. I will grant you that probably some aspects of critical race theory are in the leadership class, but not other stuff. Like, you know, if you're talking about, if I'm teaching The Bluest Eye Say, which has come under fire, by Toni Morrison, that's not a CRT text. You know what I'm saying? Like, this came out of a specific context. And, you know, so I think to what threatens people, though, and again, back to framing, is that it really threatens the idea of the stories that we've made about ourselves in this country.
Yeah.
We would have to get rid of the whole idea of meritocracy if you believed in CRT. You would have to look at your life if you're white and male and cisgendered and straight and think to myself, did I do this? Did I create my life? Or was there a huge swell of support stuff for me that I did not know I had?
Started out on third base.
Yep, there you go. And thinking you hit a triple, right? Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, there's all that. So what CRT is really doing, and this also goes, and this is not a CRT thing, but the 1619 Project, which is trying to say that this is where we should start our narrative of this country, not 1776. If you start with 1776, what are you accentuating? You're accentuating the so-called founding fathers, most of whom were slave owners, by the way. You would have to talk about the throwing off of the yoke of the British, which is a wonderful thing, you know? You'd have to start with the creation of the Declaration of Independence, who only really talked about one segment of the population when they said all men are created equal, right?
I mean, a very small segment.
Yeah, very small. Like, they weren't talking about women. And
no women.
And they weren't talking about poor white people either.
Exactly. I mean, it was very small, but very all small. Men.
Absolutely. So when you're doing, and all these things are also coming together. Now, this is something the Trump White House did very well, and then conservative media took it over, is they kind of pointed these things as the boogeymen. These two ideas, the 1619 and then CRT. CRT has been around since the damn 90s.
Yeah.
Like, that's what I thought was hilarious. It was like, we're getting all up in arms over something that's pretty, like, 40 years old.
Yeah, people are just catching on, and it's just like... Yeah,
right.
And it's back to the framing. Yes, it's the framing. They're so good at it. They're so bad.
Republicans and the right are incredible at framing. They've always been good at it. They always win the language contest. Always. Yes.
And then I was just doing my homework for this interview, I promise this is the last thing about it.
I'm having a good time. Don't stress it.
Your new principal. And by the way, congratulations to your new principal, Henry Turner.
Yeah.
I found out he was principal of the year. Who would have thought?
Yeah, a little outfit that did it, but that's all right. Here we go.
Fantastic. Yeah. But what's it called? I also saw that. I know it's from Breitbart, but he did get attacked from Breitbart saying that he was bringing it into the schools and all of this craziness. And I mean, I read through the article and I thought it was the most ridiculous thing. And then I think it was the vice principal even said that one of her daughters goes to a middle school that did the exact same thing he was doing, but no one cared because that principal was white. So
let me just add one more thing to that. It wasn't just Dr. Turner that as a black man who got attacked. It was also the new principal at Bigelow, who's a black woman, that also got dragged into this. All the schools, high school and middle schools, did work around Kenosha and Kyle Rittenhouse and all that kind of stuff. The only two people that conservative media went over were the two black principals.
Surprise.
There you go.
Surprise. Exactly. And that's the thing. It's just, where is the camera pointing today? And who is it pointing? And then you have to, it's pointing at those two principals. And then you have to ask why. They're the only two black folks. Surprise. It's wild.
It is.
But because we're talking about all of this stuff and people are going out on speaking about like just all these articles of people, everyone's online 24/7, 365. One of the articles that you sent me that I really enjoyed was the accountability, censorship, or punishment. So jumping to cancel culture.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just these two things that I wanted to jump in. And like, there's this whole article by the Pew Research Center. It was actually published in May of 2021. Like I said, it's basically about, is cancel culture accountability, censorship, or punishment? We'll go through the actual numbers in a hot second. One of the people who were part of the study that were writing comments afterwards, and they asked, they just left open-ended questions. Why is cancel culture accountability? One of them said, notoriety and embarrassment are useful tools. What do you think about that?
Well, that actually can drive into theology at some point. This idea of a culture, we've all heard the phrase, that guy has no shame, right? This might be one of the few old school things about me. I do think that shame and the idea of that can be a powerful thing, because encapsulating the idea of shame is your connectivity to everybody else. That you're not just out here by yourself.
Yes.
That you are part of a collective. This is a little bit different, but allow me to say this for a hot second. One thing that always astounded folks at World Cup venues is whenever the Japanese men's or women's team would play, okay? The fans came with their own trash bags and cleaned up their section of the stadium after the match was over.
That's beautiful.
Imagine that happening in the United States, right? But you also hear about when they're in elementary schools, like they help create the lunch. They also help clean the classroom. So there's a sense, and also how, even in this pandemic world, why they wear a mask. Like I'm wearing a mask if I'm sick because I don't want to hurt other people. Americans would never do anything.
Absolutely not. Just sneeze all over the place.
Yeah, that's so foreign to the idea. Like, wait, I got to help out my fellow person? Bump that. I think this idea of shame, I think can be a positive thing. It's like almost like the idea of admonishment, which is like an almost spiritual term for scolding.
Yeah, please help me with that. Admonishment?
I'm a religious person. So, one of the things that scripture in the Bible tells us is that admonishment can be correction from God, right? Mm-hmm. Now, I don't want to get into a whole thing in that direction, but just the idea of admonishment, of being corrected, that's not a horrible thing.
No, it's not.
And I know sometimes people are like, well, who are you to tell me, you know, that I got to be correct? And there's a little bit of that as well. But, you know, I think if we remove shame, I think we become less connected, you know.
It's like, then we're like hedonistic people. Like, what do you mean? Shame is how we keep other people in check without throwing everyone in jail. Right. Like, there's no shame, there's nothing in between breaking the law and then good people. Like, it's just a wide. Anyways, look, listen, let me not pile on the shame part, but let me give the other side before we get into the numbers too. And the same question: why is cancel culture punishment? And this is one of the quotes, responses that I liked from the punishment side. People often overcorrect in both directions.
Yes.
And then they added a quote. Remember, a man convinced against his will is of the same mind still. What do you think about that?
Yeah, you know, it's the overcorrection is interesting because you do want to believe, like, so this will get into why most stand-up comics don't play colleges anymore, and haven't played colleges in like a long, long time because nothing's funny, you know, in terms of that. And I know in the world of comedy, you know, you can always say it's just jokes, you know, and there is such a thing as punching up and punching down. You know, I will say that. So wait, say that last part, the last part of that again.
Of course. Remember, a man convinced against his will is still of the same mind. Oh, again, a man convinced against his will is of the same mind still.
So now that what that is leaving out is behavior. You know, one of the things about affirmative action is that it was never really meant to change hearts and minds. It was aimed to change behavior.
Yeah.
You know, so I would say, like, you know, this country legalized interracial marriage in 1967. You tell me if that was put to a vote in the United States national vote, I think it would lose. You know, it probably in 1967 as in the country to more than 50%, I'd seriously doubt it. But it was the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. And then people couldn't discriminate. Now, there's a whole bunch of people still today who don't think it's all right, including one senator who thought it was interesting that maybe
I just saw that. Up.
I was good God almighty.
Where are we going? We can't get Ms. Brown, Ketanji Brown in there soon enough. God help us.
I know. But I think that's the thing is that, like, maybe you won't convince their mind. And so that adage can still be true that they don't think it, but you sure as hell can talk about their behavior.
Yeah. God, you're so good. Thank you for coming on. Because I've been feeling that the same the entire time when I was going through this stuff. Because the goal isn't like, yes, if I change someone's heart and mind, oh, God bless you. Thank you. Yeah. Come on over. Let's have dinner together. But if I can't change your heart and mind, I really don't care. Just stop the bad behavior.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Just stop the bad behavior. It doesn't bother me what you're thinking.
Give me a table. Yeah,
Exactly. But just for the people at home who haven't read this paper or don't know anything about it, again, it's from the Pew Research Center, which was published in May of 2021. When they were asking, does calling people out on social media represent accountability or unjust punishment? 38% of U.S. adults said it see it as punishment. 58% of U.S. adults see it as holding people accountable. And then on the punishment side, just breaking it up when it comes to just views ideology, 59% of conservatives see it as punishment. 18% of liberals see it as punishment. Accountability, 36% of conservatives and 78% of liberals see it as accountability. Following up all those numbers, do you think that this actual calling out? So I think we agree on the standards and whether it's accountability versus punishment and where those issues meet. But do you think the actual calling out, the people doing the calling out, do you honestly believe that they're rushing? Do you think that they are rushing to judge, or do you think that they honestly trying to help? Like, especially online, and I'm speaking online. Do you think that they're helping, or is it just judging?
Both are happening, I would say. You know, and I am very judicious with who I follow on Twitter, mm-hmm. and I often, like, is in on like any kind of article I read or YouTube thing I watch, I never read the comments. I made the mistake of that like 15 years ago. I did it once. I'm like, I'm never doing that again. Ever, ever, ever. The most vile stuff is in the comments, you know? But, you know, for one, when I hear those percentages, I always think, well, who's the real snowflakes? The ones getting, you know,
exactly.
You know, in terms
exactly.
of that. You
can Come on, man.
You can look at social media in some ways. You can look at it as just people talking.
Mm-hmm.
And if people are just talking, what's different from that with the conversation on the stoop or on the porch or in the barbershop or in the park or whatever, right? Now, of course, the huge difference is the number.
Yeah.
You know, the intense number of that. So, I mean, for me, it's almost like, you know, this takes me back to comedy. This takes me back to you might have actually been in class when we showed this, because I think you haven't graduated yet, right? Is Chris Rock was talking about how we're living in the first time in history where white people have to watch what they say.
Yes, I was there. I did see it. I don't know if you did it multiple years, but I do remember that exactly. Yeah. Yep.
This is the first time where especially white men have to watch their tongue.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we've had, you know, my demographic has had hundreds of years of saying whatever the F we want. You know, now you can't, you know? And so, you know, I think accountability is, you know, first of all, a lot of people rush to judgment on social media. A lot of people do not find out what's going on. And they just, it's easy because the phone's in your hand. Yep. You don't have to research anything. And also, we're now dealing with all these kind of, you know, fake news things that come up, which is definitely a real thing, despite the term that our, you know, number 45 used. Yep. And also now we're going to start getting these deep fake video things.
I've heard about that, and it scares the shit out of me. I'm not going to lie to you.
I agree, because now it's like, oh, we got him on tape. We're like, well, did you get him on
tape? No, God, don't do it to me. Don't do it to me.
but it's like that. And so I do think that this idea of cancel culture, which, by the way, like the term woke, came out of the Black community.
Mm-hmm.
You know, cancel culture came from the disco, you know, Black disco community, right? And in the queer world as well. And, you know, it turned into something, again, framing, that is not really happening. I think in our texting before this, you know, I made the argument, like, I don't know how many people are actually truly canceled.
Oh, I love that one.
You know, they're just not, except for Kaepernick, you know, in the NFL, that brother got canceled.
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, 100%.
He's gone into his other like publishing world and activism and things like that. But in the world of football,
100%. He's gone.
Yeah.
And like, you can't even argue it even if you wanted to.
No. I mean,
exactly.
He should have started, but he should have made a team.
100%. 100%.
And so I think for this cancel stuff, I say it more as accountability. And at the same time, we also have to know context. So, like, when you asked me to talk about the race produced line, you know, my preamble was like, well, without knowing the rest of the context, you know, because that can be very misleading. Back to MLK, the content of the skin the content of our character and the color of our skin, that line is taken out of context.
All day, every day.
And people forget what, you know, what King talked about in the first part of the speech, which was about, you know, funds are insufficient, you know, of on course. The Constitution, you know. Yeah.
Don't touch my money, but we could talk about holding hands.
So, I mean, you know, so I think for that and like to include people like Harvey Weinstein and Bill Cosby in the cancel culture thing, these people rape folks.
Yeah.
All right, so let's not get it twisted and try to be like, oh, he's being canceled. Like, no, he drugged and raped people. I'm talking about Cosby, drugged and raped women multiple times.
Yeah, you know, so, I mean, so that's not cancel culture. That's going to jail. I mean,
no, and R. Kelly.
Right? Yeah, let's wrap it up. I mean, that's you just breaking the law. We're not, that's something else. And I don't think you can put that in the same conversation at all.
No, but they do.
I know, but like,
yeah, right.
And they do it for the framing. They do it so they can murky up the waters for everything else that you're talking about.
And it's a great phrase. It's got alliteration, cancel culture. I mean, it's got a nice little rhythm to it. Like,
well, they're too good. They're too good at that. No. But I do want to talk to you about some of these things that I look and listen. Mrs. Goddard, I know you just said that you need the context for all of these things, but I really tried to just understand what this was. Right. And it's impossible because at some point I got to say, I trust the New York Times at some point, because I'm not going to go talk to the Pew Research Center. I trust the study. I hope someone that is doing the editorials or whatever, at the studies or whatever, the buck has to stop with someone. And then I have to trust the
source. At some point, right? We have to trust and not, we don't have to do our own research like these anti-vaxxers, but that's okay.
Exactly. But some of these things do concern me. So these cancellations do concern me. And I want to know what you think about that. I'm just going to go through a list of a few things. San Francisco School Board voted 6-1 to remove, this is George Washington's name, from a school district. Hofstra University wanted to remove Thomas Jefferson's statue from a prominent campus spot on the campus of Hofstra. Abraham Lincoln, my favorite president. My favorite president. Abraham Lincoln's name
was... It's got to be the beard, right?
It's got to be... No, for me, it's the hat. It's the hat every time. But Abraham Lincoln's name is getting removed from the school. American Museum of Natural History wanted to remove Theodore Roosevelt's statue in New York City. Look, I want to hear people out, and I want to understand these things. But Mr. Goddard... Maybe I'm getting old. Maybe I'm old school. Maybe I'm too much and I can't keep it and I'm not as hip, or I don't get it. Am I wrong for not wanting those things removed?
I mean, your feelings are your feelings. But, you know, I mean, you have to look at each of these people case by case, you know, in terms of that. Again, framing, when the right says that this is erasing history, I would put that most of these statues is the erasing of the history. So explain. So for example, you know, Civil War, let's say that, okay. These were insurrectionists. These were people who were traitors who went against the United States so that they could keep enslaved Africans enslaved, right? And they had monuments built to them, not just around the South, but up here too. There was a Confederate monument on one of the islands in Boston Harbor. I forget which one, you know, for like Confederate prisoners or something like that. And that is the changing of the history. These were not noble men, you know, who fought for an area of the world because of this weird way of life or the notion of family.
No, they talk about state rights. They always talk about state rights. They fought for state rights. That's
right there.
Get out of here, your state rights.
Yeah, the state rights that I can enslave these folks, you know?
Yeah.
And keep my pockets lined. I mean, you know, it wasn't, and the North was complicit in this because there's no accident that we're a young country and we're filthy rich.
Yeah. Where did it come from?
Yeah, where did it come from? Exactly. So what I'm saying, so when you say this erasing history thing, back to your idea, for a lot of these folks, I think the glorification of these people is the true erasing of history.
Okay.
And so there's a wonderful book you should read called How the Word is Passed by Clint Smith. And what he does, he's a poet and a scholar. And he wrote it to basically talk about how do we remember slavery, right? And he went to several different places. He went to Wall Street in New York. He went to Monticello in Virginia. He went to, I forget the name of the slave plantation down in Louisiana that has like, you know, a real kind of, you know, history of what the plantation was. God, like stuff like Gone with the Wind, you know, people go into these plantations for weddings. Like that is the true erasing of history. And I guess the thing is that why are we afraid of it is like, you know, not the history of a people is never clean.
Oh, never. It doesn't matter who you are.
And we're just asking to have that be side by side. So like for someone like George Washington, you know, as important as he is to this country, he was a brutal slave owner who did not free a single person. And as a matter of fact, went after incredibly anyone who escaped. I mean, he was ruthless and we don't know that history. You know, and so for me, I would not want my child to go to a school like that. Now, Teddy Roosevelt to me is a little bit more complicated. Yes, he was definitely a racist guy. Yes, he was imperialistic. And he also made the most acreage in this country for national parks. You know, and he was the driving force behind the Museum of Natural History. I don't know what the beef is with Lincoln, you know, in terms of that. I'd love to hear
it. In the article I saw, it said that he allowed the hanging of 26 Native Americans for not wanting to leave. Something like that. I don't remember. Just
that is, don't quote me. That is true.
Oh, there she is. There she is. How the Word Is Passed by Clinton Smith. All right, Smith. Beautiful. And then this last thing on the cancel culture thing, because this one really hurt me. Clint Smith.
How the Word Is Passed. I do think also that if people are wrong about something, they should be allowed to be redeemed.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you know, like, I mean, like, you know, but you gotta, and it's not just you have to make the apology good. You have to make what you do after that good.
Yeah, you can't keep doing the same shit. And be
like, Louis C.K., you know, he got canceled because he was jerking off in front of female comics. Like, that's not...
a good look.
That's not a good look. That's disgusting to do, you know. So,
This one hurt me. And this is the... Look, again, I read three different articles about this, and I was trying to understand the main reason. Howard University's decision to cut the classics department. And this is another huge reason why I wanted you specifically, Mr. Goddard, because on top of the fact that you taught my favorite class of all time in high school, you're also an English teacher. You're also an English teacher. And for the past, I'd say probably 8 to 9 months, I've been texting you about all these books. And I become, as an adult, I wouldn't say avid because I'm a slow motherfucking reader, but I've become a reader, you know?
There you go.
So when I
God is not through with you yet, Zwartek.
Come again?
God is not through with you yet, Zwartek.
Listen, every single day you just get a little bit better, right?
That's right.
But when I heard that Howard University's decision to cut their classics department, that, I mean, I remember that I went to this... conference and like when I was still in Boston, and I saw a bunch, and part of this conference was about race and colleges and stuff, and then I went to this conference and then I saw the Howard men. You know who I'm talking about? You know the Howard
men, there's the Morehouse men, they got all them folks.
Oh my goodness. And they stood up and they all said, like, whatever the group, the line is, and it was the most amazing thing in the world, right? So the Howard University, anyways, they decided to cut their classics department. And in a lot of these articles, when I read about it, when they were asked, why did you do it? When they interviewed the students, the dead old white men, that statement, that temperament, that came out. But most of it was just like, we didn't have the money, so we cut the class. I mean, we cut the program that had either the least amount of people, whatever, what colleges administration does mostly. And then this is going back to Martin Luther King. He only taught one class in his entire life. And the only class that he taught was social philosophy. Scholarly. There you go. Scholarly. Soul of the Civil Rights Movement. The syllabus was demanding, and students were expected to read the greatest thinkers of political theory, John Stuart Mill, Hegel, Rousseau, Socrates, and Plato, and much, much more. When you cut an entire program from a college, and by the way, this is the only historically black college that had a classics department, and they cut it from Howard. I don't go there. It's a historically black college. And it just made me really sad. And when they asked the students and they talked about dead old white men, that hurt, Mr. Goddard.
Yeah.
I feel like that's too much. I feel like that's too much in the wrong direction. That's not what we want.
So first of all, from what I understand, they didn't cut the department. You didn't have to take classes in Greek or Latin anymore. That's different.
Oh, no. So I know exactly what you're talking about.
Okay.
The Greek and Latin, I think it's at Princeton and a few other colleges, but the expectation to learn Greek and Latin as part of the program they cut. It's gone. But Howard University actually cut their classics department, like the classics program.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know, there's part of me that kind of wonders, you know, and I don't know the specifics. So I'm going to talk out of my behind a little bit.
Of course. That's what we get to do.
Because on some level, like, you know, if kids aren't signing up, you know, then what are you going to, you know, what are you going to do? You know, keep running a department of like four faculty members for five kids, you know, like, I don't know if that's worth it. You can still read. I would bet you a steak dinner. You can still read about any of those thinkers at classes at Howard.
Oh, 100%. And they did. If you go through the articles, just to add what you just added, they said specifically a lot of those classes, like they said throughout the program, all of the classes that you had to do to finish the program, there's like three or four classes that they actually cut. But most of the classes you could still take. It's just not a program.
So this is, and this also goes back to something that I think differently of depending on the day sometimes. Like, so as an English teacher, you know, I go back and forth on whether we really need to teach Shakespeare.
Ooh, okay. Talk to me, please. Explain.
I love Shakespeare. I've taught the, you know, at one time we had a Shakespeare elective. I taught it. I've been to many plays. I love watching it. But do you need to read Shakespeare to have a wonderful, fulfilling, loving life? No.
You definitely don't.
You don't. You
definitely don't.
Are there other works of literature that can talk about similar things that are way more accessible that kids will actually read? Yes. You know, so like I go back and forth on that. You know, I mean, I personally think Shakespeare is important to know if you're going to be an English student, if you're going to look at lit, but if you're not in a pain, you know, if my parents were here, they would not be happy with me, you know, because they're both English teachers too. You know, you probably don't need it, you know, and it's like, you know, why do we keep going to these certain writers? Why do we keep going to these certain periods and say that's what it is in order to understand, to be a learned person, to be a cultured person? And that means we're going to leave out a whole lot of other folks. And this is kind of what happens when people get to college, is they'll find authors and writers and thinkers that look like them that they were never told about.
Yep.
And then all of a sudden, they first of all want to immerse themselves in that. And then also there's an anger about the education before. It was like, well, how come no one told me about this? Look at this rich intellectual and cultural lineage that I come from. And if I didn't go to this school, I never would have fucking known.
Yep. So
to go back to the classics thing, like, you know, that's a Eurocentric idea.
Oh, 100%.
You know, and like if that were just as important as more Afrocentric intellectual traditions,
the numbers would be different.
It would be a different idea of looking at, like, even calling it classics is absurd when you think about it.
So
why isn't it just Greek and Roman thought?
Yes. So I don't know. That's like I just said, I just recently got into like wanting to read, and I have a whole list of classics.
Yeah.
Thanks to you.
Still read them.
That I really do want to get through. But I want to push back on this Shakespeare idea just a little bit. I know you said you're going back and forth, so I'm happy you're not entirely out of the Shakespeare team.
I'm not.
Okay, good. because I do feel like a high school is like, let's prepare you to be let's teach you how to learn, right? Yeah. Let's prepare you for what you want to do moving forward, right? And art is like, people just reach back in the past and they say, what's amazing in the past? What is like perennial? Like, what's something that's perennial, right? Why is it perennial? And let me take a piece of that and share it with my culture, share it with my current situation. And I agree with you with the frequency at which we read Shakespeare. I think out of like from middle school to the end of high school, there's probably 2 years that I didn't read Shakespeare.
Yeah, that was a plan.
Yeah.
No, seriously, as someone like, you know, they should have a Shakespeare every year. That was our thinking.
I think that's a little much. I feel like let's cut down on the Shakespeare, right? Give me 4 years of Shakespeare and then give me some other thoughts. But absolutely, we cannot cut Shakespeare out. You know, part of my reading plan this year is to get through all of Shakespeare. You know, the No Fear Shakespeares?
Yeah.
Oh, God, they're amazing. For you kids at home, get the No Fear Shakespeare, right? I love it. I'm going through Othello. Who knew Africans were... we should read more Othello because Africans and Shakespeare make me happy. It just... they call them Moors or whatever. Just understanding that just expands my happiness with this Eurocentric view of things. But... I just wanted to add that because just as an English teacher, as just someone who's getting into the reading verse, that really made me a little sad. Moving forward,
hold on, but it does go to gatekeeping, right? What is considered valuable in this cultural space, right? So like an artist like, you know, Kerry James Marshall is probably not as known to people as someone like, Marc Chagall or, you know, Pablo Picasso, right?
Oh, 100%.
And so when you talk about particular authors and the idea of the literary canon, it's really a gatekeeping conversation. And, you know, that's when, like, who are the people that decided this was great? And I don't know if you remember this during hip hop, when we talk about graffiti.
Mm.
And, you know, there are incredibly talented cats that were painting on the trains. I mean, absurdly, you know, talented, even knowing that they're doing this in the dark, you know? And I remember this wasn't your class, but there was another class where we were talking about what's considered art and all that kind of stuff, you know, all those big ideas that this brings up. And, you know, a kid brought up the Mona Lisa on his phone, right? And then this kid said to him, like, so who said that's incredible art? And then pointed at the picture we had up on the board of this, you know, incredibly beautiful burner on a subway car. Like, who says that's art and that's vandalism, right?
And
that's the question that I think happens with people like Shakespeare and departments like classics. You know, like, who are the ones that decide that this is worthy and who doesn't? And you must know this, you know, in terms of like the, you know, the first great universities in the world were Muslim.
Oh, yes.
The Mayans are the ones who created the concept of zero, I think. You know, and
it's not that you forget. They just don't tell you.
They don't tell you.
They just
learn about Euclid and you learn about, you know, these Greek motherfuckers, you know, that
all day, every day.
Who took the shit from Egypt anyway, but that's all right. We'll, you know, talk about that another time.
But last thing, just before we move on, but you're having the conversation in the right way. When you have the conversation as a gatekeeper, you're talking about expanding what we consider important. I hate the idea of dead old white men. Why do we need to learn about them? Let's not cut them out. Let's just expand and add all of these other people in the canon, in the classics, in the whatever.
And even like teach them in concert with something else. You know, for example, my wife, she just left being department chair at Wellesley Middle School. But one of the books that she can't stand that everyone loves and it seems like there's a law. Everyone has to read this in middle school is To Kill a Mockingbird, you know?
You and your wife and I would get along.
And she's like, what? This white savior book, you know, it's like, you know, but she still had to teach it, but you can teach it through different lenses, you know? So you can teach it through like, let's look at the Calpurnia character and like, what are we not learning about this? You know, when I taught One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which is a wonderful novel. It's long, but very good. One of the ways about Nurse Ratched is that we kind of talk about how the female forces in the novel are either Madonnas or whores, or they're also these like ball cutting, no fun having things that are trying to kill masculine energy.
That's
right?
Nurse Ratched right there.
And there's like, even her name, right?
Yeah. And what do they call it? The femme fatale, whatever.
Oh, no, she's not a femme fatale. No, but what happens is that you begin to identify, and listen about this can happen to female readers. You begin to identify female forces in literature as the freedom squashing force, and the male characters as the freedom loving force. Then you start to identify against yourself reading the text.
Ooh.
Yeah, and that's
that cuts deep.
So when I teach Cuckoo's Nest, I'll call attention to that and talk about that. So even though it might be, it's considered part of the American literary canon, but I mean, it's an unbelievably sexist text.
Yeah,
I mean, it just is. You know,
I have to retract what I said about your wife and me agreeing. I was mistaking To Kill a Mockingbird. What's that book about the kid who goes to college? He's from Connecticut. Not Connecticut, maybe Boston. It's like this really preppy student. He's super sad. He hates himself. He goes to
Separate Piece?
No. It's like I read it in middle school. Anyway, it's not To Kill a Mockingbird. I actually kind of like To Kill a Mockingbird, but it doesn't matter. It's to each their own. Right. Moving forward, America has a free speech problem. You sent me the response from Thomas Zimmer, the thread, and this is just going back to that, the cancel culture bit just for a little bit.
Yeah,
so I read the article, but Mr. Goddard, I do want to ask you these questions, just quick yes and no. Over the past year, have you held your tongue because you were concerned about retaliation or harsh criticism?
No, that I have not. I think you know me, Q.
Yep.
That's, no.
Yeah. Number two, over the past year, have you retaliated against or harshly criticized another person because of something he or she has said?
Okay. Harshly criticized. That's a loaded term.
Yes, it is.
Because I could just disagree and someone thinks I'm jumping down their throat. You saw that in your leadership class every day.
All day, every day.
Regular ass disagreement and people are like, you're jumping down my throat. Like, I'll show you jumping down your throat. So I would say no, because I wouldn't say it was harshly criticized. But
I'm happy you thought about that one, because that's the only one when I answered I was against, because 77% of Americans say no to that. I said yes to it because I was also thinking, like, the way me and my siblings yell at each other, they could say hello. I could be like, get the fuck, you know? So.
Well, I can't say that to my kids or a DSS is coming. So, you know.
Right? That's what I'm saying. Right. How much of a problem is it that some Americans do not exercise their freedom of speech in everyday situations out of fear of retaliation or harsh criticism? Not at all serious, not very serious, somewhat serious, or very serious?
I think it's somewhat serious because, and this is back to leadership, kids were a lot freer with their tongues when I started. So this is actually,
you'll
learn this, Vortic.
I want to hear this, please.
This is my first year not teaching the course, right?
Oh, is it really?
Yeah. So
okay.
I finally got my way out of it. I mean, I was trying to leave for a bit because the course was starting to become associated with like me and, you know, Miss Leong. And we're just trying to get out. But anyway, so kids were a lot freer to say what they wanted to say. My first year teaching that course, I want to say, I could be wrong, it was around 2000, 2001. And
20 years?
I taught the course for 21 years, 21, 22.
Good for you, Mr. Goddard. Holy God. Jesus.
Yeah. So, so I got to see a lot of things. Also the advent of, you know, this.
The cell phone. Oh, my God. And
because that, I think, squashes people down. So I don't know if this happened in your year, but we've had years where we thought things happened in the room that were wonderful. We worked through some tension. And then Ms. Leong and I go back and think, okay, that was some good work we did. And then we come back in the next day and we didn't know that shit blew up on some social media platform between the kids in the class and undid everything we did, but we didn't know. So then we're walking in the class thinking, here's where we are in terms of our progress. And it's not there.
It's not
so I think people, and I think adults are doing this, they're not saying what they want. And so people become punks. So then what happens is, like, you know, I'll say something like, say in a department meeting, right? that has something to say about the direction of the department or like something that we want to do as an initiative. And no one will say anything in the meeting. And then they'll retreat to their separate quarters and be like, oh, you know what, God, you know what Peter said. And then there's all this back talk. And then that creates a tension that I didn't know existed. Yeah. Because I think people are just like, I think we have definitely become wimps in a huge way. And I think that that prevents our progress. And so this is what's interesting about the leadership classes is like often most classes early in my career, after the retreat happened, everyone said everything all the time.
Yes. Yes.
Like all the time. Now, not so much. So now when someone just disagrees regularly, because they're not good at it, because we haven't disagreed, you just keep it to yourself, they think that they're attacking them.
Oh, geez.
And I don't know if I ever said it to your class, but I would have to give a kind of speech about what attacking really is and isn't.
Yeah. No, I think so I was done prior to all of this. You didn't have to explain the attacking to us. And we didn't have anything. well, at least if we did.
Well, we had the N-word moment in your class. I remember
we did.
That.
We did have the N-word moment. Which I do have coming up soon, but what was I going to say? I was going to say we didn't have things blow up outside of class on online.
Yeah,
which I can so like I just totally forgot because in my head I was like, Mrs. Goddard, you're so like to be an adult and hear kids talk about these issues, you have to be so patient. Me as an adult now thinking what I thought back then. I'm like, how stupid, how crazy, how frustrating must you be in that class? So like to just not yell people, this is the answer. This is what
well, you know, it's interesting that teaching that class was good training for me. Like, you know, that then I know I can't, you know, you don't bring people along, you know, by yelling at them. And that's the one thing of that, to go back to our earlier talk about how social media works with this, you know, not many people can take getting yelled at. Some people can, you know, and the cascade of voices on Twitter can feel like a yelling. And then you retreat back to your own devices, you know, that kind of thing. But I do think that I really vehemently disagree with the premise that we have a free speech problem. Because people can still say whatever the fuck they want to say.
All day, every day. Oh, yeah.
So it's like, so give me a break with that. So I think it's kind of like, you know, we have an accountability, a new accountability, and we're uncomfortable with it, you know? And I think, you know, in Twitter, because of how, and this goes, this is why technology has to be always taken into account when we talk about these issues, is because it really reduces a lot of stuff and you don't have that face-to-face. That's what I really loved about leadership in any of my classes is when you're able to be in a space and talk it out, you know, but you got to talk it out.
You have to.
But that's what's not happening is, and then everyone knows what exactly what to say to sound not racist, homophobic, not sound.
Whatever.
They know, but
you set that up so beautifully. Okay. You set that up so beautifully, Mr. Goddard, because the next question was, do you feel less free or more free 10 years? I'm not going to ask you. We kind of went over that a little bit. It literally says 10 years ago, did you feel more free or less free? Right. But during that class, that retreat was so key because like you said, you have to talk it out. And when you have a 45 minute class, things can bubble up and then you could leave before and then you could forget. And some people forget, it simmers down. Yeah. But at the retreat, if it bubbled up, you were there, you slept next to these folks, you woke up the next day, you had to catch them when they fell backwards. You got to talk it out.
And we also went for like a 4-hour period, if you remember.
Yes, it was fantastic. Yeah. I mean, you got to really air your grievances and then hear the other grievance and understand where you had to meet in the middle or where you just misunderstood. That it was so good. And then when you came back, you could feel the difference in the class.
Yeah,
like you can feel like people are giggling, people you've never heard them voices before, talking, raising their hands, telling you to shut up. It's the greatest thing. It's the greatest thing. And like, if that goes away, it would really, really suck. It would really, really suck. Do you have an answer? Do you know what needs to happen?
Man,
make sure that doesn't happen. I mean, in leadership specifically.
Well, in leadership, you have to create you have to create an atmosphere where they can see, like, so for example, when people were less willing to kind of say what they wanted to say, when it finally happened, and then we did, and then it went well, it went interestingly, I would often say, like, I try to make sure I stopped at 2 minutes before class ended and be like, hey y'all, did you see what we just did there? Did you see what happened? We disagreed, talked about it. No one hit anybody.
Right.
You know, when we talk about, like, and this goes back to the idea of safety, right? Uh-huh. When we talk about a safe space, right? And, you know, I know that's been lampooned for other reasons, but when you talk about a safe space, like, we define safety in there. And I don't know if you remember this, but I say the first thing, and usually the kids get wide-eyed when I say this first part, I said, the first thing we're talking about is physical safety, right? Because we've had people flip chairs in here before.
Oh, shit.
Right, yeah, and then
I wasn't there.
This was back when they said what they wanted to say. This was in the old building, baby. And, and there was, I only had to get up and put my hand on a kid's chest once, because I didn't think he was gonna, but it felt like he could.
Real close, okay.
Yeah, and so I say physical safety number one, okay, is that no one's gonna get hit in here. And they're all like, what? I'm like, the stuff we talk about makes people want to hit somebody sometimes, right? And I said, you know, then there's the idea of verbal safety, right? And one of the things that has become, thankfully it's changing now, but one of the things that's become, I don't know if you've been part of any of these kinds of trainings and things like that, they always want to establish norms, right? Yep. And one of the norms has been assume good intentions. And I've never liked that, you know, because think about.
Ooh, I think I might disagree. Wait, what do you mean? Why wouldn't you want to assume?
Who are we trying to keep safe with that?
I would assume everybody. Wait, talk to me.
That's not how it works. So, for example, when we're talking about power dynamics and dominant, non-dominant things, the people who are experiencing most of the crap, whether it be a microaggression or a macroaggression, are the people in the non-dominant group. If we want to keep it racially, if a white person says some fucked up shit, and, you know, people, kids of color, like Asian, Latino, or Black kids, or like indigenous kids are like, hey, what's all that? But wait a minute, you should assume my good intentions.
Okay, I see. I hear you.
Instead of the norm of assume good intentions, the norm is something more like accept the impact your statements might have.
Okay.
You see what I'm saying?
Yes.
Because it's not all good. even if you don't mean it to be, right? Like, you know, I don't know if you've ever been on the receiving end of the you speak so well shit.
Oh, too many times.
So imagine if you'd be like, well, what you mean? Like, hey, wait a minute. That was my good intention. You know, you can't, so there's that. But I think in order to create that, like I said, when that finally bubbles up, it's almost like I have to, I don't mean it to infantilize them like this, but you almost have to kind of hold their hand and show that, like, look, we had a disagreement and it turned out all right. We came to something and we can do this again. We can do this tomorrow.
Yeah.
You know, but there are some classes where, like, they never get there. And I think a lot of it has been, you know, I think social anxiety has just, and I'm sounding like a grumpy old man now, but social anxiety has just become so much more of a force, I feel like, in my students' lives in the last 10 years.
No, it really has been. It really has been.
And if you're anxious, you're not going to say what you feel.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. You won't. You have a big barrier right in front of you. Mm-hmm. I'm almost done here, but there's just two more topics. Good. I listened to Joe Rogan, right?
All right. Well, I already came home from church today, but I'll bring you up to the altar next week. All right.
let me revise that. I used to listen to Joe Rogan. Okay. And I didn't stop listening to Joe Rogan when things popped off. I stopped a while ago.
You know he graduated from Newton South, right?
I do know that. Yeah, I do know that he graduated from Newton South. But what's it called?
Another reason to love North. But anyway.
A Tiger Pride every day, baby. Tiger Pride every day. You said that Outkast had the N-word issue. Joe Rogan had an N-word issue. I always say this. Maybe it is because I'm from Africa. My version of the word is just so different. It's so different. Like it's not that it just brushes off my shoulders. It's a situation where it's like, I can't put so much America. There's so much power in that word. Mm-hmm. Mr. Goddard, there's so much stress and anxiety and agony over that word, which makes a whole lot of sense. If you understand the history, it makes a whole lot of sense. But I think to the place that we're at right now, where you say it and then it's the end all be all, I can't agree with that. I can't agree with that. It makes me feel as a Black person so fragile. Like just the utterance of the word is going to make me fall apart, and this generational trauma is going to fall on my head. I can't live that life.
Well, part of that is you're not, that last thing you said made it sound like you're making a choice, but you're not, because you don't have the generational trauma. You know, I don't.
You're right. So that
is understandable. I think a lot of sub-Saharan African people who came in certain times might feel this way. Not sure about Caribbean, but you know, there's a little bit of that. So you don't have the history in terms of the generational thing. But what it does do is reduce you, you know, to what that term means in people's minds, right? Now, in terms of Joe Rogan, I thought this motherfucker was racist a long time ago.
Okay, wait. I'm sorry. Can I cut you off real quick?
Yeah, sure.
So when everything came out, that Planets of the Apes joke, my God, Mr. Goddard.
That's bad.
I mean, and that one hurt. I was like, Jesus, that was.
And if it wasn't for India Irie was the one who put it out, I think, right? The R&B singer, right? And I always thought he was, and he always gives this like kind of fake, oh, I'm just trying to understand things. And it's like, get the fuck, like, you know, you shouldn't be putting white supremacists on your show. I'm sorry. Yeah. Just to kind of see like, gee, I
wonder. What do you think?
I wonder where they're coming from. I'm like, you know where the fuck they coming from. You know. But I do think that we've come to a place where that word is owned by a group of people, and it shouldn't be given, like, it's like in-house jokes, you know?
Yes.
Like, you know, I don't know if you'd feel this way, but like you hear a Nigerian talking shit about Uganda, got some Uganda jokes.
My goodness. I might have to call some people up.
Right now, but if you got Ugandans making Ugandan jokes to each other.
I know those people. We're laughing. We kiki it all day. That's exactly what's happening.
So, I mean, like that's what I mean. So, like, you know, he's not in that community. Like, you know, one thing that I feel has been really interesting teaching this hip hop course for 13, 14 years now is, you know, that course. So as an English department, we kind of talked about this regarding Huck Finn and like all that kind of stuff. And it was, people were just really, you know, wondering, like struggling and this to do. And I did say this in the department meeting. I said, well, look, there is one class at Newton North that's got the N-word all over the damn thing. And it's hip hop.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. It's 100%.
It's in almost every film I show. It's in almost all the songs starting from like 88 onward. You know, once NWA hit, like,
doors
were open. You know, it's in the things I give the kids to read. You know what I mean? But we never utter it out loud. And it's always interested me how like the department's never kind of asked either me or kids who took the class, like, you know, how is the word presented there, right? And so the thing is, it's just like, I never say it out loud. If it's in a text, I'll either pause or I'll just say N or N's, but I don't say N word. That's like clunky and weird and, you know, all that kind of thing. So, and the word also means something in that community that it doesn't mean in mine. you know, even though I feel like I'm part of that, you know, hip hop community as someone who's, you know, been places and done things. But I just feel like, you know, I don't know if you've ever seen Ta-Nehisi Coates. I'll text it to you when this is over. Ta-Nehisi Coates had a kind of, you know, answered the question about using the N-word. And he was basically saying, like, you know, when my wife and her friends get together and they might use certain terminology, I don't feel the need that I need to use that. And of course, they're talking about the B word. You know, I don't feel the need that I need to be able to say that. You know what I mean? And so,
of course.
I think for me, Joe Rogan is not going to get, I mean, he got, what's his situation? Is he, I know he's off of Spotify. Yes.
I really don't know. I really don't know, but I do know that he continues, like he's still doing his thing, right? Like,
exactly. So yeah. What canceling are we talking about? You know?
Oh, nothing. People were just yelling at him and he was just like, yeah.
And he should take it.
Of course.
And then leave it alone. But I mean, I think, you know, for you know, and this might have to be a particular to the United States, the word, like centuries of hate and dehumanization are in that word, you know, depending on who's using it. Yeah. And what context. So here, I'll tell you a quick thing. I had a black male student 2 years ago who took both leadership and hip hop. Okay.
Oh, that was me. I'm kidding. But I did the same thing.
You did, yeah. So this brother. Oh, so talking about cancel, we can talk about your man Bambaataa, but that's a whole.
Holy shit. You know, okay. Yeah, he does some wild shit. Yeah, oh, he did do some wild shit.
But I can't get rid of him in the chorus. That would be irresponsible.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I just have to say.
He literally.
Let me teach you about Afro Bambaataa, and he sexually abused boys.
Yep.
You know, I just have to say that, right?
Of course.
Anyway, shoot, what was that?
2 years ago, kid did hip hop.
Yeah. So he did hip hop and leadership, right? So during at the end of the Black Identity Unit, he talked to me and he says, yeah, I don't think I want to take this class anymore. Now this was.
Wait. Hip hop or leadership?
No, leadership.
Oh, shoot. Okay.
So here's what we said. So I said, well, you know, let's get at this because, you know, you're a great voice in the room and this and that. He's like, I just, when I go in there and we start talking about blackness in whatever way, I just feel just depressed. And, you know, these, you know, kids are looking at me and this and that. And I said, well, you know, my man, like, tell me this, like, riddle me this. Like, you know, we talk about very similar things in hip hop. What's the
difference? For real, though.
Right? What's the difference? And he didn't say it as clearly as this. It took like a while to get to it, but basically what he was telling me was like the context in hip hop is one of joy and self-empowerment. The context for leadership was a deficit, right? Now he's the only kid in my entire teaching career that took both that wanted to leave leadership. Most people still love doing it, right? Yeah. But when I heard that articulated this idea that like, no, but the center of hip hop is black joy. The center of hip hop is self-love. The center of hip hop is, you know, I'm worth something. Yeah. And he wasn't feeling that in leadership in the same way. So like that made it really like, you know, so I've told this story to as many people as I can.
That's because, so beautiful.
Yeah.
He crystallized something. I mean, like he and, just, me, this is 10 years after leaving that class, both those classes. And I'm like, that's exactly right. You didn't have those weird moments in hip hop. You never had those weird moments in hip hop. Wait, by the way, actually, there was a thing in hip hop where it was really messed up. It was a very male heavy class. And you correctly talk about the misogyny. So when there's like one or two females in that class, when you bring up the misogyny, that's rampant. Right. In hip hop, I don't know how it feels to be a female, but God damn it, that's a rough time to be a hip hop fan.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know if you remember that woman in the film I showed. You know, she used the metaphor. It's like hip hop is. Yeah, you know, she's a woman in the industry. You know, hip hop is my man, and he beats me.
Oh shit! You know? Yeah, I mean that's exactly it. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. No, but that student definitely yes.
Right. So I think his and the reason I tell the story to a lot of my fellow educators is because one of the things that we often do, particularly white teachers or teachers who aren't Black, is they're not centering Blackness in their teaching. They're centering this other stuff, right? And that can, and even though you think you're helping those kids of color out, you might not be, because you're basically saying, like, you know, here's the problem. And even though the problem might be something worth talking about, they're somehow hearing the idea that I ain't shit. Yeah. Hip hop is never telling you you ain't shit. No, hip hop is building you up, you know? So, I mean, that's a whole different. So I thought that was, you know, really
it's good. Literally a Black man grabbing the mic and saying, I matter. I mean, that's what hip hop is. That's what hip hop is. Yeah. And then just to finish off on the greatest article that you sent me. This article, listen, it puts everything together, and I'm going to put the link in wherever you're watching this down below, because it's the idea of framing and how mainly the right has won the battle for, they said like 40 to 60, is it 40 years, 60 years since the... just a huge amount of time where the right has not just won the battle of framing, they have made it their like number one goal. They have all of these institutes, the Heritage Foundation, the Cato Institute, all of these
influential.
Oh my goodness. And the amount, and they talk about how these politicians literally have like cookie jars and pizza jars where you have to pay money when you use the wrong terminology. And they use examples that, like, when you hear it, you're like, oh my goodness, tax relief. You hear tax relief, and as someone who doesn't know the nitty gritty of what's going on, tax relief sounds fantastic.
Sounds great.
I want some tax relief. Give me some tax relief, right? And just the understanding of how the right has framed every major issue is genius, and at the same time horrifying because they're so good at it.
Yep.
First, let me just hear you just talk to me about how does that make you feel, and I mean, why did you send it to me?
I send it to you because one of the things that you know, one of the greatest, dumbest things we've ever told our kids is sticks and stones will break my bones, but names will never hurt me. What that is basically saying, language is not important. Language is all important. It completely changes how you think of things. You know, and what I liked about the article also was not just the framing of specific words like tax relief and things like that, but even the framing of what it means to be a successful person and what it means to, you know, because then you fit all of that through that prism of the idea of like the world is competitive. And so you have to look out for yourself. It kind of goes back to that collective thing that the Japanese people seem to have.
Oh yeah.
That we don't. Same with Scandinavian countries, you know, like, you know, people be like, well, you know, why would you want to live in Denmark? They tax you at like, you know, 50, 60%. I was like, yeah, but everything's free.
Exactly.
School's free, you know, healthcare, like all the stuff that's making you broke is, you know, is kind of free. And they also believe in the idea of we're in this together, right? So I think what the framing thing, you know, really does is that it allows you to not, as the author says, you don't have to know the truth about anything. Nope. You just go with what it feels like. So, you know, even more recently, like, you know, I don't know if you've paid attention to this, you know, the idea that maybe making the Supreme Court bigger, right?
Oh.
Now, the phrase that's being used to talk about that is called packing the court. That's not making the court bigger. Once you use packing, it's like, well, who's trying to pack it? You see? Right? First of all, the court's
it's a little scary when you try to pack the court. Why are you packing the court?
Packing the court with these liberal things. And here's the other one that they came up with: activist judges.
Oh yeah.
Now that's only supposed to be a slur on any liberal judge. One of the most activist decisions ever made was Citizens First United, that allowed corporations to be the people.
Poor money. Yeah. I mean, if that's not an activist move, I don't know what is.
What is, right? So you know. You know, even, you know, global warming was probably a bad term that progressives came up with. They should have said climate change.
And from now, the get.
Yeah, but we've already kind of lost.
Exactly.
Because
exactly.
Of global warming, if it's like cold in March, like, oh, where's your global warming now? Like, weather and climate ain't the same, baby, but that's all right. That's too complicated, you know?
Right.
I mean, I think I said this in a text to you, like the fact that the term death panel had any kind of traction in politics. This was back when Barack Obama was trying to make the Affordable Health Care Act, which people started to call Obamacare. There's another framing thing. It's the Affordable Health Care Act. The Affordable Care Act. Don't let anyone tell you any different. People say Obamacare. I say, oh, you mean the Affordable Care Act? You know, like that. And so, you know, they were saying that there was going to be government bureaucratic, you know, bodies that would determine whether you lived or died. And they called them death panels. Now, that is a completely batshit crazy idea.
It's ridiculous.
But it had legs. And that was a term that was carefully thought out. You know, all these kinds of things. Like, you know, one of the things to kind of go with this framing thing, which is usually what we don't pay attention to. Guy at my church, Ron Sullivan, gave a really interesting talk. He's a Harvard law professor, gave a really interesting talk about where we should kind of look for things to kind of come down the pike, right? And quite often, this is what the Republicans do, the Democrats don't do, is they fight the battles on the state level all the time. So when Trayvon Martin was murdered, you know, we heard about this stand your ground law in Florida, right? And we thought, well, isn't that some crazy shit in Florida? Come to look, I think, I could be wrong, I think over 30 states have stand your ground laws.
It's crazy. It's insanity. Which
is basically a permission to kill if you feel threatened, you know? And like, you know, all this stuff going on now for anti-trans stuff going in all the states.
Don't say gay.
The anti-CRT stuff. Like, there, if we don't pay attention to that, but a lot of that has to do with framing. And I think, you know, that has also to do with dog whistles. Dog whistles and framing are the same thing.
I just was pulling up the actual Medium post because I highlighted it here on my phone. Yeah. And I just wanted to go over this just so we can talk about. So we're talking about the actual framing, but the mm-hmm. author of the article goes back to the worldview, which you were talking about. It says here, that is what framing is about. Framing is about getting language that fits your worldview. It is not just language. The ideas are primary and the language carries those ideas, evokes those ideas. So, this is the part that made me connect everything that we're talking to together.
Yeah.
This is the framework that is usually on the conservative side of the aisle. It is further assumed that the only way to teach kids, this is about the strong fatherly presence.
Yes.
The strong fatherly presence, right?
And heavily rooted in patriarchy.
Yes, of course. I mean, that's what it is, right? That's what it is. Right. I mean, God is the old man with the white beard. What are we talking about, right? So that worldview that you need that big paternal presence that tells you what to do. He knows, right? You don't question him. Versus the liberal side of seeing things, the nurturance. Once you put those worldviews and then you try to have these conversations, it makes so much sense where people would line up.
Yes.
Because when you look at these strong paternal worldview and why people are so cancel culture and wokeism and all of this stuff, it makes so much sense because the paternal, especially because it's the young kids these days that are telling you that these are bad things that are happening, that we got to change the language, that you got to make space for other people, that you got to watch what you say, or you can't just get away with all of these things. Right. First of all, it's always the young kids in college that are making everything so bad. And that's not what the paternal strong fatherly presence is about. So I just love this whole framing situation. But then I wanted to ask you, you said that the left is losing, and even in the article he speaks at the point that we're always on defense because we have no choice, right? When someone goes and they says this, you know, the wokeism is breaking the culture, you can't just be like, I don't agree with your framing. You have to answer the question. So it always feels like we're on defense. But why do we pick such bad titles? Why are we so bad? Like,
I really don't know.
Mr. Carter, I have to ask you, defund the police? What is this?
Yeah, see now.
What is this?
Yeah. So that.
Come on, man.
That was probably not a good slogan. even though what it was saying was accurate. They're not saying get rid of the police. they're saying, let's maybe not give them all this money that allows them to be a paramilitary force.
100%.
And have it go somewhere else. But when you hear defund, it just makes people think that I'm trying to get rid of cops.
It's so bad.
Now we can talk about that a little bit, you know. Right? You know, but you know, because in other countries there are police, but they don't always carry guns. They, you know, the whole training's different. You know, none of them have freaking tanks, I'll tell you that. Yeah. But you know, I think you're right. Defund the police was not, like, as much as I heard it, it probably was not a, you know, productive slogan. And I don't know what it is. And I think what I loved about this piece also was it lets you, it makes you resist calling conservatives stupid.
Oh, thank you.
You can't say they're stupid. They actually have thought about this, created, you know, a linguistic framework to work in and to be more effective than you. If you want to call that stupidity, then that's on you. This is actually freaking brilliant what they're doing. And you know, I don't know what it is, and there's part of me that thinks, you know, sometimes people do not want the, you know, five paragraphs or the eight paragraphs of what it actually is. Give it, you know, and this is where you can talk about maybe the people not being so smart. You know, just give me the easy thing. Give me the bullet points.
Yeah. But like the thing is,
and progressives, do not give the bullet points.
No, we want to tell you everything, the research, the
which
numbers.
Which is true, but like you said, who gives a fuck if it's true?
For real. No, but for real. I don't, it's, and because, and it, no, the reason, and again, what you're saying makes so much sense to those worldviews. When you look at that argument, bullet points versus explaining, the nurturing type of worldview, you have a conversation with the person you're talking to. This is what's going on. This is what I think.
The ins and outs of it. Yeah.
Exactly. But the parental, paternal, strong paternal worldview, I tell you what to do, it's done. So you don't have to have a conversation from that worldview. You just need someone strong to tell you the right thing to do, and you're supposed to do it as best as you can.
So when the Affordable Care Act was trying to be passed, right? Pollsters did an interesting thing. They first asked people, what is the favorability on the Affordable Care Act? And by that point, the Republican media storm had done a good job. And a lot of people said, I don't like it. So then they started asking them about things that actually were in the bill.
Yeah.
And do you like that? And they're going through a 75% favorability rate on like what's actually in the bill. The name of the bill, they said, no, that's bad.
Yeah.
Okay, here's what's in the bill. Do you like that? Yes, actually that's in the bill. Okay, part two, do you like this? Yeah, you know, that's actually in the bill. You know, so, you know, that's a branding thing.
It's a really hard, this seems like the crux of so much, because if we could just get people to, and he points to this over and over again. He's like, people are not just purposefully voting against their own wants and needs. They're just following their worldview. That's all they're doing.
They think they're voting for it.
Yeah, exactly. They think that's what they think. And it's a difficult one. It's a difficult one. To wrap this up, sure. Mr. Goddard, it's just because, and thank you so much. I want to keep this specifically on the race stuff.
Okay.
What do you think the goal is? Like, for the longest time, I really did think the goal was content of your character, not the color of your skin. I really thought that was the goal. I mean, I really believed that was the goal, right? And it just seems like in today's culture, the goal is to change the hearts and minds of people. And I don't know if that's a worthy goal. And if, okay, listen, let me just leave it open-ended. What do you think the actual goal is? What are we chasing? What do we want? What does Black Twitter, what does, you know, the progressives, the liberal left want when it comes to this race culture conversation? What is the end goal?
I mean, I find it, you know, I'm only one person, you know, I can only speak for what I see and what, you know, my family's experience has been. So I don't presume to be the almighty white voice on this, you know, you know, that kind of thing. But it seems to me that what is desired is the ability for everyone to be able to grow unfettered. Just to be able to grow, to be able to blossom, to be able to feel true freedom, to be able to not have an institutional thing stopping them or a personal thing from stopping them, you know, from being like true self-actualization. Mm. And the reason, you know, this is why when we talk about the idea of dismantling race, the concept of race has inherently in it the idea of power. It was never about difference. It was always about power.
Yeah.
And so if we can get the power shit out of this, you know, this idea, and I don't know if that's it's not possible in my lifetime, I can tell you that. I do not think we're going to get rid of racism in my lifetime. And I'm really not sure about my kids' lifetime. Maybe my grandkids when they get to be adults. There are several things that have to happen. One, I do hope, and hope means that you don't see good evidence. Okay,
that's exactly right.
All right. My hope is that this whole thing with Trump and all these folks is white supremacy's death rattle. And that, you know, and it sounds crass, but more of these folks need to die off in order for a lot of these young ideas to still emerge, right? President Trump would never have been president if there wasn't President Obama first.
Oh, yeah.
There's freaking way. That was the racist backlash to a Black president. And you will see this in American history. Whenever there's progress racially, there's a backlash. You know, it always happens. And so, you know, for that real spirit of self-actualization to occur that I talked about earlier, you know, it's not color blindness. It's the idea that that differences don't matter. And that you're just a different, you just look different than I. That's but you're no, you're not in a ladder. Mm. We have to get rid of that ladder. And I don't know, man. Like, you know, that's
so look, and that's a real goal. And that's a real goal because okay. Yes, I agree with you. I agree with you. But Mr. Goddard, that's such a hard.
Yeah.
Like it's not only hard because the idea is so big and it's such an honest truth of what so many people I know and myself believe and want, but it's not tangible. Dr. Goddard, if you told me, let's get less Black folks out of in prison. I mean, let's get less Black folks in prison.
Yeah.
I'm like, that's something we can actually see and measure and understand. Let's get more Black men in college. I mean, the Black women are kicking some serious ass when it comes to going to school. Mm-hmm. I mean, they really are. But what, like, if those are some real goals I can get behind and start pushing and understanding. But when the goal is destroy an ideology or like systemic racism, institutional racism, those are things that every single day, the older I get, the harder it is for me to wrap my head around. It's so hard for me to pick and choose how do I fight this in the institution without knowing what exactly I'm fighting. And it's an idea and it's a thought process.
But it's also, you know, this is, and I remember Karis once saying this in intro to one of his songs where he basically said, there's no such, and this is a little provocative, but you'll see the point I'm trying to make. There's no such thing as a government. It's just people pushing around people, right?
Oh.
So when we talk about institutions, yeah, they're institutions, but their institutions are made up of people.
Yep, that's all they're made up of.
And this is where it's going to be hard in terms of racially. Do we put our hope in white people? Because until we stop racism, it ain't going to stop. So white people have to get in each other. We have to get in each other's faces about this and change it. White people have to end racism. Men have to end sexism.
Mm-hmm.
Straight heterosexual people need to stop homophobia. It's not in their interest to do any of this. You know? And that's what's so depressing.
See, when you put it like that, it makes a lot more sense, because you like it's, as a Black person, it's like so hard to try to understand what it feels to be white. But whenever I have these issues, I just like switch it and be like, let's talk about men and women. And oh my God, it makes so much sense, because there's so much I can do as a man to prevent this stuff. Like when it comes to sexism, right? And the misogyny, it's literally like my day to day, the conversations I have with my friends on the phone. It happens the second I answer the phone. You should have seen me last night. Like immediately, right? There's so much you can do. So I hear you. Look, listen, we could do this for years, but Mr. Goddard, thank you. Thank you so much. I haven't done one of these Everyday Hero shows in a while. I've been traveling all over the country. And by the way, me being a travel nurse, and I went to Texas, and I'm in Cali, and I was up in Maine, I was in North Carolina. I went to all of these places, and people are so good. Like, human beings are so good. I know people in Boston might have like an idea of what people in Texas are. By the way, folks in Texas, get vaccinated, please. God help me. So that idea is true. They're not as vaccinated as they should.
My daughter's in college in Florida, so I know exactly what they're talking about.
I'm praying for her. But I mean, like, some of the nicest human beings all across this country, all day, every day. Absolutely. And that's why, like, the older I get, I'm like, when you see these people face to face, it doesn't matter where they get their news. People are kind, good human beings. So the whole internet part is what makes everything feel so toxic. But in real life, you just, everyone's love, most
people. No, I'm with you. I'm like I said, I'm a prisoner of hope. And I always go into thinking, I couldn't be a teacher if I thought people were inherently bad. You know, I don't think I could do it. And that's not a great way to live life anyway, thinking people are inherently bad.
Mr. Goddard, thank you so much.